Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Mohsen Sazegara, who is one of the founders of Iran's Revolutionary Guards. He was also a former deputy prime minister in Iran, and he's now the president of the Research Institute for Contemporary Iran. We'll be looking into the fact that the recent electoral coup in Iran was conducted by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, and we'll also look into the role of the Supreme Leader's son, Mojtaba Khamenei, and other issues involved in the story that seems to be missing largely in the press about who really is behind this coup. And then we will look at the major energy and climate bill that was narrowly passed in the House this week on a vote of 219 to 212. We'll be joined by a researcher and staff writer at the Center for Republic Integrity, Marion Lavelle, who has written a study, The Hidden Cost of Clean Coal, and arguably clean coal was the winner in this, in the sense that they, in order to get the bill passed, such compromises were made such that that coal will be with us for some time. And of course, coal is the major contributor of global warming, or burning coal for electricity. And then in the final segment of the first hour, we'll talk with Michelle Goldberg, investigative journalist, New York Times bestselling author, former senior writer for Salon.com. We'll be talking to her about C Street that was referred to by Governor Mark Sanford in his rambling mea culpa that was laced with the Christian double talk. C Street, where the adulterous Republican governor sought counseling, is affiliated with the Fellowship, the obsessively secret Arlington spiritual group that organizes the National Day of Prayer Breakfast. I'm now speaking with Mohsen Sazegara, who, as I mentioned, is one of the founders of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. He's also a former deputy prime minister of Iran and is now the president of the Research Institute for Contemporary Iran. Mohsen, do you agree with my premise that the press and the media in this country is largely seems to be missing the obvious, which is this electoral coup that just took place in Iran was largely engineered for the benefit of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps?
Yes, I do. This is a coup which has been designed in Revolutionary Guard. A small faction in leadership of Revolutionary Guard, which are very close to Mojtaba, son of Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader. One of the top generals of Revolutionary Guard, one of my old friends, he's not in key positions right now, but he's very respectful in Revolutionary Guard. He called me about 10 days ago, a few days after that coup, and told me that, Mohsen, please tell to the nation of Iran that we don't agree with this operation. And the majority of Revolutionary Guard, they don't agree with them. And he told me that there are strong rumors inside Revolutionary Guard that Russians are behind. I don't know, because I don't have any documents, but I just want to show you the atmosphere inside Revolutionary Guard and what they think.
Well, ironically, of course, Mohsen, the Ahmadinejad's government, Khamenei's government, who's really in control, they are continually trying to put out the word that the United States and of course, the Zionists, but more so the British are behind this coup. They've had people appear on state television, young students who have probably been tortured into confessing, saying that a BBC reporter hired the people to kill that young woman who was shot down in the street, and the images were shown all around the world.
You know, this is a very, very old and several times repeated scenario by the government of Iran that every opposition person, group, and even a majority of the nation, when they oppose their decisions and whatever they do, they accuse them to be the agents of the United States or British or Israel government. Unfortunately, we have bad news from our friends in jail now. More than 1,000 politicians and activists are now in jail, and they are under torture. They are under torture for confessions, shows to be broadcasted by the state-run exclusive radio and television of Iran. And the scenario is that, yes, it has been a velvet revolution designed from CIA, paying $400 million, spending $400 million for that. This is what Kayhan newspaper, the organ of the leader, wrote it a few days ago. And they wanted to manipulate Mousavi, the presidential candidate and the legal president of Iran right now, by the vote of the majority of nations. So this is what they want to do that. As you know, this is a psychological war. And what we worry about that on these hours is we are afraid that during next few days, if they broadcast some of these confession shows, then they may execute some of the activists and then, you know, arrest even Mousavi. This is very, very sensitive moment on this situation now.
And Mohsen, the role of the British, which seems exaggerated to us because we all know what happened in 1953. There was a coup against Mossadegh, and in effect you could argue that the American CIA also conducted that coup against the British, because the British lost control of the Iranian Anglo-Iranian oil company and the Americans moved in and basically installed the Shah. But for some reason or other, this government fronted by Ahmadinejad and controlled by Ayatollah Khamenei is making a big deal about the British. Could that have something to do with the fact that the British seized about $1 billion of Mojtaba Khamenei's accounts in London, which may have been IRGC accounts? And of course, they have arrested British diplomats or deported British diplomats, and now they're arresting the people that work in the British embassy, who are local people.
This is very, very strong rumor amongst the Iranians. If you go to Iranian websites on these days, which is one of the most important battlefields between the nation and the coup government, you can see lots of news and assessments about this account, which has been blocked by the British government, and whatever you said has been described on these news and assessments. But I think that besides to that, I don't know. Nobody has the, you know, exact information that what kind of account this $1 billion British pounds was and how they used that. But besides to that, I think that the regime has two more reasons to concentrate on British government. First, they want to recognize the nation that this is a conspiracy like the coup against the nationalist Prime Minister of Iran, Dr. Mossadegh, in 1953. Because, as you know, that coup against Mossadegh was designed by and pushed by British government in those days and by the help of the CIA. So they want to pretend to the people that, yes, this is another conspiracy by British and Americans. This is another reason. And second reason, I think, that they, you know, sorry, put finger on British instead of the U.S. That was before the recent stance of President Obama. They hoped, especially Ayatollah Khamenei, that they can keep the United States in a neutral position somehow, not to isolate the coup government and save them for next negotiation. They have promised the United States that if we take the power over, we'll come for negotiation and solving the problem of nuclear issues and terrorism in the region. But I think that the recent stance of President Obama and the pressure from the press in the United States, the opposition of him in Parliament, in Congress and House, and even from his party, I think, and his recent speech on last Friday has changed the scene. So I guess that the coup government will attack the U.S. more than before.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Mohsen Sazagara, who is the former one of the founders of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, who are the people behind this electoral coup. He was also a former deputy prime minister in Iran. He's now the president of the Research Institute for Contemporary Iran. And clearly, this coup is designed to take the republic out of the Islamic Republic. The Iranian people have been very unhappy with their government, but the one thing that they had was real elections. And now that's been taken away from them, and it's obviously been an insult to their intelligence. And this is definitely showing signs of a kind of fascist rule. And when you mentioned that the rumors now are that the Russian, presumably the SVR, the Russian former KGB, are involved, and perhaps Putin is as well, they certainly are showing signs of a kind of Stalinist style of repression, are they not, where they force people to pay for the bullets that killed these young students. I just don't understand how they think the people that they can claim to represent the people that they're brutalizing. How can they get away with it?
I don't know either. You know, right now there is a hard struggle from the people to push the coup government back, and it's very simple what they say: give our vote back. We want our vote. This is very simple demand, and people have tried to demonstrate this demand in peaceful marches and silent marches even. But as you know, they have started murdering the people, violent actions against the people, arresting, and they use all the KGB tactics to suppress the people. For instance, when they want to arrest somebody, they go at 5 o'clock or 5:30 in the morning, attack to the houses to, you know, confuse the victim and to create a kind of fearness all around that house, and several other tactics. I mean, this is, if suppose they succeed from now 1 year later, they will be the king of the cemetery. They will be, you know, they will have a country, a government without any legitimacy, a country that is filled by hopeless people, people who don't trust the government at all. All around the world, Iranians will be against such a government and will continue demonstration against any official of this government. All the intellectuals of the world will support people of Iran. And yes, you are right. I think that they will be in real trouble, especially that now this is what we are pushing for, that, and we ask the international community to put pressure on this regime, isolate coup regime, and tell them very frankly and clear that if they don't stop killing the peaceful protests of Iranian citizens, then they will put sanction on oil of Iran. It can be the most effective tool that the international community can use it in the sake of the people of Iran.
Yeah, of course. Good luck getting Russia and China to go along with that. But just in closing, I mean, there is a concern. There's a couple of a prominent Iranian Americans, Trita Parsi and Reza Aslan, have a piece out now called "In the End of the Beginning." They're concerned that the Iranian diaspora, as you know, there's a lot of factions within the diaspora, and the people, the pro-Shah people, are in many ways in bed with the neoconservatives who brought the disaster in Iraq. And of course, the neoconservatives are also in bed with the MEK, the Mujahideen al-Haq, who are just absolutely the worst people in the world. So there's a fear that the regime that just conducted this coup will be able to continue to show that there's outside meddling. But my question to you, Mohsen, just in closing, is why doesn't President Obama tell the American public and the world the truth about what we're talking about? He knows that this is an IRGC coup. He knows that Mojtaba Khamenei is joined at the hip by Ahmadinejad. They both share this messianic religious fervor, you just mentioned £1 billion has been confiscated from Mojtaba's accounts in London. Why doesn't he lay it out and delegitimize them in the face of the world?
I don't know. You have to ask President Obama, but what I know, and as an Iranian, I expect the President of the United States, who wants to have the image of Martin Luther King and Abraham Lincoln in the world, what I wish to hear from President of the United States is leading the world, the democratic world, against brutality and the murdering of coup regime in Iran. And I believe that if U.S. leads the world, European countries will join U.S. and they can put sanction on any company, even Russian and Chinese company, who deal with Iran's oil, and it will work and will isolate them as well. This is, it can be only my wish, but you have to ask President Obama. And I think that for diaspora and all other Iranian groups, something which is very wonderful, that everybody in the world, every Iranian, we have, we call ourselves as a green chain for democracy. And every person and every group is just a link in this big green chain for democracy, from small cities in Iran to Los Angeles to Australia, all around the world. And we say welcome to any Iranian group that very clear says defends nonviolent and peaceful actions and democratic the struggle of the people of Iran, and wants to be a link in this big chain.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles today, Mohsen Sazagara. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Mohsen Sazagara, who is one of the founders of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. He was also formerly a deputy prime minister in Iran. And he fell out with the regime. He was a reformer, I suppose, is the term that's used. He spent 7 years in the notorious Evin prison, which is now where, of course, all of the dissidents and students, etc., are being rounded up and tortured. There's two sections of that prison that are controlled by the IRGC and the Intelligence Corps. Of course, the Intelligence Corps is totally controlled by Mujtaba Khamenei, the son of the supreme leader, who is, as I said, just joined at the hip with Ahmadinejad. They're both apparently messianic religious fanatics, not to mention fascists. I'm now speaking with Marion Laval, who is a staff writer and researcher at the Center for Public Integrity. She's an investigative journalist focusing on energy, environment, and climate. Previously was a senior writer at U.S. News and World Report, spearheading a groundbreaking investigative report on environmental justice called Unequal Protection, which was the winner of the George Polk Award, the Investigative Reporters and Editors Award, and numerous other honors. And she's also written for the New York Times, Washington Post, and she's co-authored a book called Toxic Deception. She's also the author of a report from the Center for Public Integrity, The Hidden Cost of Clean Coal. And Marianne, could one argue that in this narrowly passed bill on the major energy and climate bill that was just passed in the House by 219-212, many environmentalists feel that clean coal is the winner here?
That argument could certainly be made, or at least coal of any type is a winner, because in order to get this bill through, and it was a very difficult vote. The numbers you read, 219-212, that is very close. They had 44 Democrats defect and vote no, and 8 Republicans voted yes, and they needed every one of those 8 votes. And Chairman Waxman and Chairman Markey, the two advocates of this bill, got it through was making a lot of compromises to win over those wavering Democrats in the coal states in the Midwest and South.
And when you say coal states, there are obviously Kentucky, West Virginia is where the coal is dug up, but there are the other states where they have coal-fired power plants.
Yes, you'd be surprised. I certainly was surprised. Indiana, for instance, is considered a coal state, although there is barely any coal being mined there today. But 97-98% of their electricity comes from coal. They just ship it in from Wyoming. The Wyoming coal is a much better quality for meeting the acid rain regulations, so that's what's happened in that market. So very little of Indiana's economy depends on coal, very few jobs, and yet the politicians there are terrified of when the coal industry has brought up this issue, that if you reduce reliance on coal, coal is the cheapest form of energy, of electricity, and the electricity prices in Indiana, Kentucky, the states in the center of the country, there's a lot of fear that those electricity prices will go up and the politicians will be paying the price at the election booth based on this bill. So that is what the advocates of doing something on climate, what they were facing with when they brought this to a vote.
Well, but the point about coal is it may be the cheapest form of generating electricity, but it's the most polluting and the greatest contributor to global warming.
Right. And a really interesting thing is that in California, very little of your electricity is derived from coal. Californians have some of the lowest per capita use of electricity in the country. If the rest of the country would insulate our houses, use more efficient appliances, turn off the lights, do all of those things to conserve electricity, we would be paying a lot less, even if the price per kilowatt is higher. That's the trick, and that's what really hasn't gotten through to folks, and what the advocates of doing something on climate haven't been able to get past. It's not the price per kilowatt hour. It's what you do, how you use energy. And we're all going to have to be part of the solution. Right now, what they just decided to do was pass a very weak climate bill to get enough votes in place.
Well, in California, of course, they've replaced coal-fired plants with natural gas, and we know that there's a powerful natural gas lobby out there. We've seen ads on television from T. Boone Pickens and others. You'd think that they'd be a counter-lobby to the coal lobby. I understand Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, is totally in their pocket. They've obviously got a lot of people. But they are also doing enormous environmental damage in these coal states, cutting the tops of mountains off. And of course, at the end of the day, being the biggest contributor to global warming, they may be doing catastrophic damage to the planet itself. So how are they getting away with this obvious canard, clean coal, which is, I suppose, as cynical a concept as safe cigarettes?
The coal industry really realized that they were under fire as the world became more and more aware of the global warming issue. Coal is essentially carbon, and you can't separate the two. You can't scrub the carbon out of coal, certainly not very easily. So what the coal industry did was they embarked on this new program launched last year to rebrand coal as part of the climate solution. Now, there are ideas out there for how to capture the carbon from a coal electricity plant. They can use some of the technologies that have been used in other industries for doing that, but at great cost. The idea of clean coal does not jibe with the idea of cheap coal, and but the coal industry has with advertising, just very aggressive public relations, they have kind of merged those two ideas and added another element, which is they say, and this is true, the United States has large reserves of coal. So they've made it kind of a national security issue. Let's rely on a domestic source of energy, coal. So they've kind of dressed up coal in advance of this battle over climate change. Henry Waxman of California and Ed Markey of Massachusetts, a year ago, they both advocated a moratorium on coal plants until we get some sort of clean coal technology that's really feasible and affordable in place. The two of them, fast forward to this year, they're both in leadership positions. They want a climate bill passed. They decided to craft a bill that brings in coal, that spends $1 billion a year on clean coal technology. But even more important than that, It has a very slow ramp up. The goals are very weak. We can talk about it, but they don't come near to what the UN's scientific panels say is needed by the time of 2020 if we're going to avoid catastrophic climate change.
Well, indeed, it's been very controversial. Many people in the environmental movement feel that Ed Markey and Henry Waxman were rolled by the coal lobby, and there's also a split in the environmental movement. A number of the NRDC, for example, supported this compromise, whereas others like Greenpeace didn't.
The majority of the large groups did support this compromise. NRDC, Environmental Defense Fund, just many of the large groups. Greenpeace was somewhat alone in saying, you know, don't even vote for this bill. The rationale that NRDC and EDF and the other environmentalists have is that we've got to get some sort of framework in place. And this is what was done with the Montreal Protocol to deal with ozone. It was very weak when it was first put into place. But slowly it was ratcheted up until it became the most successful international environmental treaty we have. Nearly 98% of those ozone-depleting gases are gone. They hope that as the world becomes cognizant and aware every day of climate change happening in their lives, the political will grow to make this law stronger. Mm-hmm. And what they want to do is get the levers in place so they can be pulled when push comes to shove.
Well, I guess when they have beachfront property in Arizona, the voters will figure out there's a problem. But it's somewhat a Pavlovian approach. If the UN says that if we don't address it, we can pass a tipping point. But I get what you're saying. But Marion Lavelle, again, the staff writer and researcher with the Center for Public Integrity, the author of a study, The Hidden Cost of Clean Coal. You mentioned how they put in $1 billion to a sweetener for the coal in lobby for clean coal. There was a very instructive interview by the most powerful guy in coal. He runs a big, I don't know what the name of his company is, but he was on 60 Minutes, and he was touted as being Mr. Coal, but he also believed in that global warming was real.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the most revealing things about that interview was when the 60 Minutes asked him about if he believes in clean coal, and how much are they spending on making clean coal, because that's what they advertise, that we're really looking, we're the future and we're going to have clean coal. And there was this embarrassing silence, and the guy says, we haven't spent a penny. So the coal companies are not spending a dime on clean coal, at the same time touting it as if it's real, and it's the poor taxpayer who has to pony up. Isn't that somewhat...
The coal industry's position has been that... the people should be paying for this kind of research because it's a public benefit, and that it is so risky that who's going to pay for the first efforts at this when there's likely to be failures, and how can they answer to their shareholders? And so you'll find that especially the coal mining companies have put very little money to clean coal research. Some of the utilities have made some efforts, but most of them really want a lot of public money, either state money or federal money, to really help in this effort. So if clean coal happens, we're going to have to be paying for a lot of the research.
Well, there is a pilot plant, I believe. I can't remember where it is now. Somewhere in the Midwest, I think, or the Northwest, where they have sequestered it, but they have to turn it into a liquid. I'm talking about the CO2, and it's incredibly expensive. And I can't see how, in the long run, you can stick all this enormous amount of CO2. First of all, it requires energy to concentrate it and liquefy it.
Right, and then there's the whole question of you'll have to bury that. Where do you bury it? What protections are there from having a massive escape of CO2? There are all kinds of issues, many issues, and yet... We do have technology for alternatives right now, and some of them, natural gas certainly is an alternative that is pretty cheap to put up a new natural gas plant.
They did it in California after the big Enron ripoff, where they had to did a crash program to build a bunch of them.
And they can do it very quickly.
Right.
And there just was an assessment came out a few weeks ago of U.S. Natural gas reserves bigger than ever, a huge 30% increase in reserves. You don't find coal or oil reserves increasing anywhere in the world, but the technology is getting better and better for extracting natural gas. It's it's about half of the CO2 of coal. It's a cheap and easy way, and the coal industry knows that if you had a strong climate bill in place, the utilities, the electric companies would immediately be switching to natural gas because it's clean, it's available, it's easy to do. Another thing is that the renewables, like solar and wind, become more and more attractive. And then as they become more attractive, they get to that critical mass where the equipment is not as expensive, and it really becomes a real competitive alternative. So
now, is there anything in this bill, Marianne, that helps? Or, I mean, we were talking about how much they've caved into to coal.
Yeah.
Have they given anything for alternatives and research?
Yes. The bill sets a certain standard that is, again, far weaker than originally planned. I believe it's something like 15% renewable energy, but you can meet quite a large portion of that with energy efficiency measures. Both of those are very important, but why trade one against the other? Ultimately, it was a compromise. They decided to do both instead, to not force utilities to do both, to really kind of not make it as stringent as it would have been. So there's a little bit for renewables. There's a little bit for every form of energy in here. In order to get votes, the important thing is that it does not have as strong goals as one would hope in really reducing our carbon emissions to a level that all of the world needs to reduce its carbon emissions in the next coming years.
Well, just in closing, Marianne Lavelle, then, it would seem to me that understanding the way Washington works and how this climate bill was lobbied to death and watered down largely by the coal lobby, mentioned earlier that there is a natural gas lobby. So, are we left to hope that the T. Boone Pickens of the world will buy as many or more congressmen than the coal people bought? I mean,
what you really hope is that the people who aren't in these industries, but the consumers and the people who care about the environment and our energy situation and really transitioning to a clean energy economy, that they're the voices that will be heard. Not enough of them are engaged in these issues, and that really allows just the people with money to be heard. The polls say people care about climate, but there's a lot of belief in Washington that it's not a winner voting for this bill. The next step will be in the Senate, and it's going to be a very hard battle there as well. Some of the leadership don't even want to bring the bill forward. So I think they would need to hear from a lot of voters and a lot of regular consumers who care about climate.
I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles, Marianne Lavelle.
Glad to be here.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again. Marianne Lavelle is a staff writer and researcher at the Center for Public Integrity. She's the author of a new study, The Hidden Cost of Clean Coal. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm now speaking with Michelle Goldberg, who's an investigative journalist and New York Times bestselling author, a former senior writer at Salon.com. She has written for Glamour, The New Republic, Rolling Stone, and The Guardian in the United Kingdom. She was a finalist for the New York Public Library's Helen Bernstein Book Award for Excellence in Journalism and has taught at New York University's Graduate School of Journalism. Her previous book was Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, critically acclaimed bestseller, and her new book just published is The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World. And we're just all witnessed, Michelle, the tortured, rambling mea culpa of Governor Mark Sanford, which was laced with Christian double talk, And in the painful preamble to his confession of adultery, he mentioned that he went for counseling at C Street.
Mm-hmm.
And C Street is a very interesting and it's affiliated with the Fellowship, which, according to the Washington Post, is an obsessively secret Arlington spiritual group that organizes the National Day of Prayer Breakfast. So can you give us an idea about what's going on in this house at 133 C Street, where several Christian congressmen live and various Christian senators come by,
Essentially, the Fellowship is, I mean, I think that one of the strange things is not so much that Sanford would be affiliated with C Street, but just that he would mention it, because it's one of those things that on the one hand is hidden in plain sight. The Fellowship is a very secretive kind of Christian organization, but at the same time it's involved with organizing one of the most public of Washington events, the annual Washington Prayer Breakfast. But essentially, it runs a dormitory, which a number of congressmen live in when they're in D.C., which is itself is a fairly odd thing. Some of the most right-wing congressmen and senators live there, including, interestingly, Senator John Ensign, who himself was recently involved in his own affair and his own scandal. And essentially, it is a group that's organized it doesn't just involve Americans. They also kind of reach out to Christians, leaders in Africa and Latin America. And it's kind of a soft theocracy is, I think, what they're going for. It's not so much that they want to necessarily march on Washington and overthrow the government and have us all ruled by some kind of cleric. It's more that they imagine a Christian fellowship, a kind of enlightened coterie of biblically blessed men, and it is all men at the top, even though there's women involved in the fellowship, who essentially, have some kind of divine commission to make the rules for the rest of us.
Well, I should think, Michelle Goldberg, it'd be a hard sell theocracy after what's happening in Iran, with a theocratic coup by the Revolutionary Guard Corps, led by a couple of messianic lunatics, Ahmadinejad and the son of the supreme leader, Mojtaba Khamenei. But just to touch on your point that it's not just American politicians that are affiliated with C Street. Apparently, General Suharto, the Indonesian dictator, is an alumni, or was. The Honduran general and death squad organizer Gustavo Alvarez Martinez, a Deutsche Bank official disgraced by financial ties to Adolf Hitler, and, of course, the Somali dictator Sayed Barre are among...
Certainly, the religious right in the United States is much less powerful than it was even a few years ago. And although they would, this might be their kind of their goal, but it's certainly kind of further from fruition than it has been in a very long time. That said, I think it's important to realize that this movement, which I called Christian nationalism in my book Kingdom Coming, is still very much alive, especially at the international level. I mean, you see it now incredibly active in Africa, where there are, kind of huge inroads being made by American-style Pentecostal movements and a lot of ties between, African leadership and the American Christian right. And in fact, there's actually going to be a conference in August, not organized by the Fellowship, but organized by another international religious right group called the World Congress of Families, which is going to bring together fundamentalists from all over the world to basically discuss their kind of common purposes and, possibilities for alliances in Amsterdam.
Well, tell me if I'm over the top here, Michelle, because I'm just looking at what happened in Iran to my mind, the closest parallel would be to imagine the United States run by a theocratic cabal of the Reverends Robertson, Hagee, and Dobson, who keep the people in line and enforce moral strictures via vigilante militias composed of young rural Christian soldiers who purify society by rounding up immodest women and killing abortion doctors, you know.
I'm not so sure that that's what the people at the fellowship have in mind. I think, as I said, they have in mind a much kind of softer version of theocracy, you know, one right. that relies on, you know, kind of a generation of enlightened Christian leaders. I mean, I think that, you know, it's more like George Bush than like a Christian Ahmadinejad, but that was pretty bad too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just wondering, though, for example, just this last week, apparently, Fox News' ratings have gotten higher. And so there's mm-hmm. And they're getting more strident in their attacks on Obama. And some people, even within Fox, are saying that they're worried that they're going to, you know, give some crazy people with guns ideas. There's also, I did a forum at the UCLA Hammer Museum with Mark Potok and Chris Hedges recently, both of whom are alarmed at the rise of Christian nationalism and a violent form of it, which was manifested by that fellow who shot the doctor in his church in Kansas. So can you give me a sense of what's happening, not so much at the C Street level, because you've clearly dealt with that, but in terms of the a kind of constituency out there that's angry, alienated, and heavily armed? Did I lose you? It appears that I've I don't know what was the question I asked or whether we had but we need to call Michelle right back and continue the conversation, assuming that I didn't say something that turned her off. I can't imagine I did. Michelle, are you back? Hello?
That.
Oh, great. So I thought my question must have been terribly offensive.
Yes, and I just said, forget, I'm done with this interview. No, I'm really sorry, my phone went dead. Apparently, you know, maybe they're listening.
Oh, yeah. But. Well, I'm one of their favorites. So just give us a sense then of this, where we stand, and not so much with the C Street people, as you say, want a soft theocracy, but the more hardcore, growing group of alienated people in the red states and in the South who are don't like Obama, don't like what's happening, are being told by Fox News that it's all terrible, and they're heavily armed.
Well, you know, I wrote a story a couple of months ago when, do you remember the Department of Homeland Security issued a report on possible right-wing terrorism and right-wing domestic attacks?
Right.
And there was a lot of angst among conservatives. You know, Michelle Malkin essentially accused the Department of Homeland Security of waging some kind of, you know, smear campaign against the legitimate right. But in fact, almost everything that the Department of Homeland Security predicted has since come to pass. You know, they predicted that there could be violence against abortion providers. They predicted possible kind of racist and anti-Semitic violence, you know, violence by people who have paranoid ideas about the Fed and one world conspiracy theories. And we're just seeing, you know, kind of one after another of these attacks. And it's interesting, you know, some of the stuff that you hear on, say, Glenn Beck is the kind of thing that during the Clinton administration you heard on, like, the kind of far-right, you know, demagogues who would be broadcasting, you know, via kind of shortwave radio or via, you know, basically you're seeing a kind of mainstreaming of the underground radicalism that festered around the militia movement during the Clinton administration is now being broadcast into millions and millions of homes with a kind of gloss of legitimacy.
Well, the case of the doctor that was murdered in his church did get their attention, but as you know, Bill O'Reilly was challenged by a colleague of yours, as a matter of fact. I saw her,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Joan Walsh. And, you know, it's so strange that I remember the founders of the neoconservative movement said, the father of Irving Kristol said, a neoconservative is a liberal who's been mugged by reality. What I find extraordinary is that the neoconservatives and their mouthpieces like O'Reilly refuse to deal with reality. I don't know how you can have a political debate in a country where one half of the debate doesn't believe in data and facts.
Well, and I actually think that you're right to a certain extent that, yes, certainly Bill O'Reilly is not going to budge before reality. But significant numbers of people are, which is why the Republican Party, I think, has become almost a victim of its own success. You know, the far right, the Christian right, and various other kind of right-wing factions set out to take over one of our two major political parties, and they've succeeded to the extent that there's no place in the party for anyone else. You know, which is why it is now just a kind of preserve of demagogues and ideologues and radicals and fundamentalists of various stripes.
Well, how can they maintain that, though, with people like Anson and their sort of the pantheon of their elders, if you will, fall from grace one after the other?
Well, I think that to outsiders, it's certainly not going to help them, and it's certainly going to drive home their reputation for sanctimony and hypocrisy. But I think that among believers, the whole narrative of sin and redemption is so powerful. And the idea behind this kind of, you know, hysterical insistence on really strict social strictures against homosexuality or against adultery or against, you know, what they describe as sexual sin of various kinds is actually based on this kind of unspoken assumption. Those things are so incredibly tempting that only a system of social control will stop us all from acting out in the most intense ways, or in the most kind of perverse ways. You know, one of the things that's so interesting about the GOP's language on homosexuality and the Christian right's language on homosexuality is, again, the assumption that it's so tempting that if we relax these boundaries, then everybody will do it. And I think that you get in this language a hint of the longings and the rumblings that are, you know, that are
right,
kind of tormenting people within this movement.
So.
And so I suspect that, you know, assuming that Sanford repents, assuming, you know, he's able to make peace with his family, he'll actually, you know, there's actually room for that within that vision of the world. And in fact, that vision of the world actually sees, you know, kind of total morality as almost an impossible ideal, but one that you expect your leaders to constantly strive for and affirm.
Right, and then, just in closing, the notion that marriage is a zero-sum, mutually exclusive resource, that if gays get married, that somehow it takes away from heterosexual marriage, that there's only enough of it to go around,
it's an obscure... on the one hand, anybody who's not already part of this movement, it just seems ever more preposterous and ever more insulting that these people would presume to tell other people what kind of marriages are and aren't appropriate.
Exactly. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, so I guess I'll give you a call the next time a Republican, as John Stewart said, Republicans have conservative minds and liberal pictures, so
yeah, well,
stay
I guess
tuned.
We'll be talking pretty soon then. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Michelle Goldberg, investigative journalist, New York Times best-selling author, former senior writer at Salon.com. She's the author of a recent book, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, and her most recent book, The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World. I thank the KPFK senior producer, Alan Minsky, for some help in producing this program today, and Anthony Castillo, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.